not sooner, not later. I mean, this is pretty straightforward. So any peace, any proposed peace deal must involve that. And it doesn't sound to me very likely that a peace solution could have been reached at any point in the first months of the war, while the Russian army was occupying large chunks of Ukraine, which then the Ukraine, if Ukrainians were pushed into a peace deal, for example, in summer last year, they would have had to concede large chunks of their territory, which they later liberated. So it doesn't seem very likely to me that a peace deal could be reached by, could be negotiated by some third party last year, and I don't think it's ethical for anyone to claim credit for the effort, because any peace resolutions that don't involve the Ukrainians and it's just let's have the Americans and or the British or someone else negotiate a peace deal, or blame someone else for torpedoing such a peace deal. That would any peace deal of that kind would involve, Ukraine conceding parts of its territory
Alexei,
to the aggressor.
Alexei, we have to break now,
Russia.
But we're going to bring part two of this conversation at democracynow.org. Alexei Kovalev, investigative editor at Medusa. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio's fundraising drive for 2022 was a tremendous success. Thanks to our listeners, our goal of $70,000 was exceeded. Stitching communities together brought folks together for the love of independent media. The beloved KBOO community extends gratitude to our members, supporters, staff, and board. And a big thank you to our volunteer programmers. Your on-air support was the backbone of this membership drive. Tax receipts are available. Please send your request to membership@kboo.fm. Since 1968, KBOO has relied on members to support grassroots broadcasting. Thank you. Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an update on the impact of COVID, RSV, and the flu this winter. An effort to get an overdose of sugar out of school meals.
My bill asks us to get the data on whether we are providing adequate time for children to eat, and if not, what adjustments would we make.
And will protections for grizzly bears in the West become endangered? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 9th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. The Oregon Health Authority held a briefing today about COVID-19, as well as RSV and the flu. Dr. Dean Seidlinger, health officer and state epidemiologist at OHA, gave an update on the respiratory viruses circulating in Oregon.
We kept in place the mask requirement for healthcare settings to protect workers and the people they care for. This requirement for healthcare settings covered those who work in any place where healthcare is delivered: hospitals, long-term care facilities, mobile clinics, ambulances, outpatient facilities, dental offices, urgent care centers, counseling offices, school-based health centers, complementary and alternative medicine locations, and others. Exceptions were healthcare facilities or medical offices where no healthcare is delivered and no patients are allowed, or areas that are physically separated from patient care areas. Members of our healthcare workforce have been on the front lines of Oregon's response to the COVID-19 pandemic throughout this public health emergency. They have weathered Delta and Omicron surges. They and people in their care needed the added protection of masks, which have proven themselves over the course of the pandemic to be highly effective means of reducing virus transmission, not only of COVID-19, but other respiratory viruses, including influenza and RSV. But we recognize that we are entering yet another important, more sustainable phase of the pandemic. Even as we monitor for temporary increases in COVID-19 and influenza B activity in the coming weeks, overall hospitalizations are expected to continue trending downward. And 86.6% of people 18 and older in Oregon have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, while 24.5% have also gotten the bivalent booster. If these trends continue, we anticipate being able to safely lift the healthcare masking requirement over the coming months. Thank you to all the healthcare providers who continue working so hard to provide care for us as we need it. But we are still operating under an emergency because of the hospitalizations for patients with respiratory diseases. This allows our healthcare partners additional flexibility to care for patients that show up for needed care. Any change to the healthcare masking requirement must be made carefully in consultation with our healthcare and local public health partners and our senior health advisors in the Oregon Health Authority and leaders. As we move forward through this new phase of the pandemic, please know we are re-examining all pandemic-related policies in place, including masking in healthcare settings, and we'll be sharing additional information as it becomes available. Now, let me run through the numbers. RSV activity has dropped significantly since its peak during the week ending November 19th, when more than 25% of the RSV tests were positive, and the RSV hospitalization rate in children reached 13 per 100,000. RSV test positivity is now at 5.2%, and we're seeing just under 2 hospitalizations per 100,000 children. RSV continues to circulate and may continue causing a handful of illnesses through early spring, but we are close to the end of RSV season. We have seen a recent slight rise in influenza activity driven by influenza B virus. We do often see increases in influenza B late in the flu season as cases of the seasonally predominant influenza A virus decrease, leaving flu B to essentially fill the void. This is why we continue to remind people, especially parents of young children, that it's not too late to get a flu shot, as influenza B tends to cause more severe illness in children and young adults. During the 2022-2023 season, we experienced the earliest seasonal peak of influenza since the H1N1 pandemic in 2009. Not surprisingly, we have also seen the earliest plunge in flu activity in that time. Influenza test positivity peaked at 32.3% in early December and is now at 0.8%. By comparison, the peak of the 2017-2018 season wasn't reached until mid-March, and test positivity didn't drop below 5% until the end of April. This tracks closely with what's happening across the country, as seasonal influenza activity continues to decline nationwide, and the proportion of laboratory specimens testing positive for influenza declined for the 7th consecutive week. COVID-19 test positivity has increased in the last 2 weeks. However, COVID-19-related hospitalizations have been stable, following a steady decline since late December. We believe that the XBB.1.5 Omicron subvariant is now predominant here in Oregon and is likely the cause of our recent increase in test positivity. We do not know if this will lead to increasing hospitalization. Modeling from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention predicts that COVID-19 hospitalizations will remain flat during the month of February. Overall, hospital admissions for respiratory illnesses have declined dramatically since early December. However, hospitals remain at or near capacity as large numbers of people continue seeking care for all types of medical conditions. As conditions continue to improve in Oregon, and as our state and the rest of the country finally begin the formal wind down of the pandemic response after more than 3 years, we are seeing more positive changes that speak to the normalization and manageability of COVID-19 in our lives. For example, on February 1st, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, removed the requirement for a positive COVID-19 test result prior to prescribing the antiviral medications Paxlovid and Lagevrio, which reduced the risk of severe COVID-19 infection in individuals at increased risk. This change acknowledges the limited accuracy of COVID-19 tests and allows providers or prescribers to consider symptoms and exposure history when diagnosing and treating COVID-19 infection. This ensures anyone with risk factors for severe disease, such as people 50 and older, those with underlying medical conditions, those who are under or unvaccinated, and individuals from communities of color and tribal communities.
And that was Dr. Dean Seidlinger, the health officer and state epidemiologist at the Oregon Health Authority. Oregon leaders in the fight against hunger are campaigning for Senate Bill 610, called the Food for All Oregonians legislation. It would make food assistance available to Oregonians who are excluded from SNAP benefits due to immigration status. Aldo Solano Mendez is the strategic partnerships manager at the Oregon Food Bank.
Oregon Food Bank and Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon came together in 2021 with the shared vision of a more equitable and just Oregon, where immigration status does not perpetuate poverty or limit access to our safety net. To move closer towards that vision, we are introducing legislation this year that will address an exclusion and food assistance programs that affects immigrant, refugee, and COFO communities in particular, and that is connected to Oregon's long history of racism. From the beginning, our effort has been guided by a steering committee made up of community organizations who serve and are led by impacted communities. It is also supported by a diverse coalition of more than 85 organizations and allies from across Oregon. In the short term, the problem that we're trying to address with our bill, Senate Bill 610, is one that community has experienced for a very, very long time, and one that community leaders have called for a solution towards. We know that despite significant investments and despite several important pieces of legislation to advance immigrant rights in Oregon, things like Century Promise, Universal Legal Representation, Cover All Kids, the Oregon Worker Relief Fund, despite all this, current food assistance policies continue to exclude more than 62,000 Oregonians from the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, sometimes called SNAP or food stamps, simply because of immigration status. Amongst the people who are excluded from receiving benefits are lawful permanent residents under the five-year bar, deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA recipients like myself, Compact or Free Association community members or COFA citizens, people with temporary protected status or TPS holders, undocumented immigrants, and anyone in the process of seeking asylum. Immigrants, refugees, and COFA community members in particular have long faced higher rates of hunger and poverty in Oregon. Just one example, Latinx and Pacific Islander families experience hunger at twice the rate of white Oregonians pre-pandemic. And we know that this gap has only widened as our communities continue to struggle.
Patrona Dominguez Francisco is with Adelante Mujeres.
The reason this campaign matters to us is because our vision as an organization is a community where all families thrive. And in doing so, it means that all families must have the adequate and basic resources to do so, including access to food. Food that is culturally relevant and is free of systemic barriers that perpetuate harm to communities of color, immigrant communities, and communities with mixed status families. So when we conducted our listening sessions a year ago, one of the common threads we heard within the communities we worked with is, one, feeling like they were secondhand me-downs at food banks. They mentioned that they would receive food that felt like nobody wanted to eat and or food that is expiring or is already expired. So I just want to take a moment here and ask you to quickly imagine how you would feel if you would receive a box of food that you don't like to eat, yet that's all you have for the week. Secondly, the high prices of food limit them to purchase any healthy choices or purchasing more organic food if they even get lucky, which is a heartbreaking situation because many of the families who share their experiences are farm workers or have worked in the fields, a job that feeds all of us, but somehow forgets to nourish the same people who provide our everyday meals. And lastly, our community experiences anxiety of even asking for support to address their food insecurities.
State Senator Winsley Campos is a sponsor of the Food for All Oregonians legislation.
We also have a solid group of legislative supporters on this bill. The last count that I saw was about 17 legislative supporters. And, you know, from a personal perspective, as the daughter of immigrants, as somebody who has faced food insecurity in my life, I know the impact that this bill will have on communities. And I am so proud to sponsor this, to be a champion for this issue. And I'm very excited for the continued work with partners here to make sure that we get this done this year. Thank you so much.
Lawmakers need to act on the legislation by March 17th if it's going to pass in the state legislature's current session. Parents may think their kids are getting healthy meals at school, but according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 92% of school breakfasts and 69% of school lunches currently exceed the standard dietary guidelines for added sugar. Now, as Suzanne Potter reports, a bill filed Tuesday would set guidelines for the amount of sugar added to all school meals in grades K through 12 that participate in the National School Lunch Program.
Starting next year, school lunches in California could get a lot healthier if a new bill passes that would set guidelines for added sugar. Senate Bill 348 would limit the amount of added sugar to 25 grams a day. State Senator Nancy Skinner authored the bill to improve the quality of school lunches now that California is providing two free meals a day to all public school students.
For many of these kids, that's more than half the calories they'll consume in a day. We need to make sure that our meals are as healthy as possible and don't contribute to chronic diseases like diabetes.
Just last week, the Biden administration unveiled new guidelines for sugar, salt, fat, and whole grains that will be phased in over the next few years. It's a reversal from the Trump administration policy, which argued that stricter guidelines do little and generate more waste if children reject the healthier options. Skinner says the bill also directs the state to study whether kids in school currently have sufficient time at lunch to eat.
My bill asks us to get the data on whether we are providing adequate time for children to eat, and if not, what adjustments would we make?
According to the American Diabetes Association, more than 4 million Californians have diabetes, and another 10.3 million have pre-diabetes. The bill does not address food sold in vending machines or at school functions. I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is American Heart Month. The American Heart Association wants people to be trained in using hands-only CPR. About 350,000 people suffer from cardiac arrests every year. As Deborah Van Fleet explains, you can save a life by calling 911 immediately and performing chest compressions until paramedics arrive.
With a heart attack, people often have warning signs, but with cardiac arrest, they may not. It happens when the heart's rhythm is so severely disrupted it stops beating and can be caused by a number of conditions. Jennifer Jaeger with the American Heart Association says cardiac arrest usually doesn't happen in the type of dramatic settings portrayed in the media.
Most of the cardiac arrests that happen in the home, so it's likely going to be someone that you love, and so you want to make sure that you're in a place where you would be able to do something.
Jaeger says calling 911 is the important first step, and that science shows using hand compressions without breaths is just as effective for adults. She stresses that conventional mouth-to-mouth CPR is still recommended for drowning victims and small children. About 350,000 people in the U.S., children and adults, suffer cardiac arrest outside of a hospital each year, and less than half of them receive immediate help before emergency responders arrive. Jaeger says you don't need to be certified to save someone's life, and no one should let fear of hurting someone keep them from administering CPR.
A few broken ribs, those things are fixable, but the longer somebody goes without their heart pumping that blood, you're talking about permanent damage and most likely death.
Linda Dixon of St. Louis experienced cardiac arrest 15 years ago when she was 36 years old. One nearby person immediately called 911, and two nurses who were present administered CPR until paramedics arrived. Dixon realizes how lucky she was.
I've talked to numerous firemen that show up at an event and no CPR has been done, and they just know that after that long of a time without CPR, your survival chances are just awful.
Dixon says her cardiac arrest was blamed on myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart that was probably caused by a virus. More information about hands-only CPR, including training videos, is available at heart.org/CPR. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Coalition of Communities of Color's legislative agenda in Salem. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, rain showers early, becoming steady light rain overnight, a low 44. Tomorrow's weather, the rain showers continue with sunshine later in the day, a high of 51. Today in history, on this date in 1994, Nelson Mandela became the first black president of South Africa. Our quote of the day is from Nelson Mandela. Overcoming poverty is not a task of charity, it is an act of justice. A senior Russian diplomat said today that Russia-U.S. relations are in a state of unprecedented crisis without any signs of improvement. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov is concerned the White House's emphasis on increasing weapon supplies to Ukraine to ensure Russia's defeat is harming diplomacy efforts. Rybkov warned that the U.S. and its allies must carefully assess the risks stemming from supplying the increasingly powerful Western weapons to Ukraine. He said that Moscow does not trust the West's statement about self-imposed restrictions on a range of weapons supplied to Ukraine, suggesting such assurances in the past have served as cover for a steady expansion of arms deliveries. Rybkov said, quote, "We don't see any sign of reason in any of the NATO and EU members' capitals. What they are doing isn't going to strengthen their security. The Americans need to thoroughly and deeply weigh the risks linked to the unabashedly cavalier course," end of quote. The deputy foreign minister rejected a U.S. argument that Russia's refusal to allow inspections of its nuclear facilities represents a breach of the New START treaty. That's the last remaining nuclear arms control pact between the two countries. The New START Treaty, signed in 2010, limits each country to no more than 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads and 700 deployed missiles and bombers. Oregon tribes open a new addiction recovery center. A Sioux tribe is in federal court over a law enforcement lawsuit. Nathan Chasing Horse is charged in federal court. And Representative Davids honors tribal higher education. With the stories impacting Native communities, here's National Native News.
The Oglala Sioux Tribe is suing the U.S. Interior Department and its agencies for violating the nation's treaty obligation to fund law enforcement on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Parties spent the day Wednesday in federal court in Rapid City, South Dakota, the first day of a two-day evidentiary hearing in front of federal judge Roberta Lang. Victoria Wicks has this report.
Alden Young is the current chief of the Oglala Sioux Tribal Police. He spent the afternoon on the stand telling of an overwhelming number of calls for assistance handled by 33 federally funded police officers and 8 investigators. Chief Young told of the situation also outlined in the complaint filed with the court. These few officers patrol 5,400 square miles, holding 40,000 people living or conducting business on the reservation. A former chief of police, Ron Dubre, testified that at one time, the Oglala Tribal Police had 113 officers funded through government grants and programs. But as those programs died out, so did the level of law enforcement. And then crime rates went up, involving drugs, guns, violence, and murder, even before the advent of heroin and fentanyl. After the first day's testimony, Oglala Sioux Tribal President Frank Starr comes out, spoke about the lawsuit.
For decades and decades and decades, we've been ignored, put on a back burner. Today, we're taking that stand, not only as a tribe, but as a nation, and speaking for an Indian country. We need to be heard.
The lawsuit alleges that the United States has an obligation to provide protection and law enforcement under treaties, including the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. The tribe says in briefs that the treaties are still alive, having been reaffirmed by Congress, federal statutes, and legal precedent. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde's fight against opioid addiction has expanded to Portland. KLCC's Brian Bull reports on this week's grand opening of the Great Circle Recovery Center.
A crowd gathered for drumming, remarks, and a ribbon cutting by tribal and Multnomah County officials. Tribal chairwoman Cheryl Kennedy says Native American overdose deaths have increased by over 500% since 2000.
We have to act now. It's affecting our younger people at a greater rate, but it has no boundaries. They can be elders as well. It's devastating.
Kelly Rao, health and wellness director for the tribe, says the clinic staff is trained for fentanyl, which is 100 times more potent than morphine.
It is stronger than any other illicit drug out there, and it is a quick addiction process for people.
The Grand Ronde opened their first opioid clinic in Salem almost 2 years ago. They say they've treated 500 people since. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
8 News Now reports federal charges were filed Wednesday against former Dances with Wolves actor Nathan Chasing Horse for sexual exploitation and child pornography. Chasing Horse is accused of sexual assault against women and children spanning decades in multiple states and Canada. Prosecutors allege he claimed to be a medicine person to gain the trust of indigenous people, and he's accused of leading a cult. Chasing Horse was arrested last week in Las Vegas. Bell was also set on Wednesday for $300,000 by a state judge. He faces several charges in Nevada. Congresswoman Sharice Davids introduced a resolution Wednesday designating this week as National Tribal Colleges and Universities Week. It recognizes their contributions to the economic, educational, and social well-being of Indian Country. There are 35 accredited tribal colleges and universities in the U.S. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
President Biden takes his economic message on the road as Republicans try to refute his State of the Union address. And the House votes to end COVID-19 vaccine requirements for foreign travelers. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
The dividing line in America is no longer between right or left. The choice is between normal or crazy. It's time for a new generation of Republican leadership.
Following President Joe Biden's State of the Union address, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders gave a combative rebuttal on behalf of the Republican Party, calling the president unfit to be commander-in-chief. She criticized the Biden administration's handling of the economy, immigration, crime, and foreign policy. President Biden traveled to Madison, Wisconsin Wednesday to rally supporters, some political observers noting the language of the State of the Union, which repeated the phrase, "finish the job," predict he will run for a second term. Biden spoke at a union training center to highlight the implementation of the American Rescue Plan, the infrastructure law, and his plans for adding more middle-class jobs to bolster the economy.
We're building an economy where no one's going to be left behind. My economic plan is about investing in places, people that have been forgotten.
Former Twitter executives testified and defended the company's decision to limit distribution of a 2020 report related to Hunter Biden's laptop. The hearing was an opportunity for Republicans on the House Oversight Committee to address concerns over alleged censorship. Former Twitter Deputy General Counsel Jim Baker dismissed conspiracy theories and defended his handling of the situation.
I'm aware of no unlawful collusion with or direction from any government agency or political campaign on how Twitter should have handled the Hunter Biden laptop situation.
Some Republicans believe tech companies like Twitter have colluded with the federal government, while some Democrats like California Representative Katie Porter say this is the latest attempt by Republicans to question and relitigate the outcomes of the 2020 election.
We have been going back and forth about this supposed suppression of a single news story from a single outlet for a single day.
President Biden's cabinet is expected to soon have a new opening, and some Asian American members of Congress are ready to push for who they think should take the job. They're getting behind Deputy Secretary of Labor Julie Hsu to replace outgoing Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh. It would be Hsu's second attempt vying for the position. Finally, on Wednesday, the House voted to end the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's rule, which requires foreign travelers entering the U.S. be vaccinated for COVID-19. It comes the same day as public health officials like Dr. Rochelle Walensky from the CDC testified on the pandemic response since the onset of COVID-19.
Entering the fourth year of our activated response to COVID-19, we are moving faster than ever to deliver information to the public.
A small business nonprofit is applauding economic progress following President Biden's State of the Union address. As Alex Gonzalez reports, the organization says small businesses are crucial for Western states like Oregon and Nevada.
Del Newsom with Small Business for America's Future says Biden's speech was focused on cultivating a sense of optimism. Newsom says while the economy is still recovering, he's happy to see signs of resiliency that the president highlighted, despite some Americans fearing a looming recession. Newsom says 99% of Nevada private enterprises are considered to be small businesses, which employ about 42% of working Nevadans. Newsom adds small businesses are a lifeline for Nevada, which he says have helped diversify the state economy in the past 15 to 20 years.
Everybody thinks of
of casinos and mining when they think of Nevada. The small business community is growing leaps and bounds, and I think that's what's important.
Newsom cites a recent Wall Street Journal report that says small businesses are responsible for most of the net job growth in the United States since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, accounting for almost 4 out of 5 available job openings. Newsom says he sees many opportunities for small businesses to grow as a result of the economic policies laid out in the Inflation Reduction Act. Newsom says his group's research has found 74% of small business owners from across the country agree with the law and its provisions. As an example, Newsom says the law has helped control high health care costs, which have plagued small businesses for far too long.
When you think about overall the job that has been done over the past couple of years for small and diverse businesses included in some of these laws, it's unprecedented.
Newsom says when looking at the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is focused on fixing the country's roads and bridges, it's important to remember the improvements it'll bring to broadband, IT, and electric forms of transportation, which he says small businesses will be able to tap into. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Conservationists consider grizzly bears to be an umbrella species, meaning protecting them allows for the protection of hundreds of other species by maintaining large tracts of wild spaces. As Eric Golatis reports, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering delisting grizzly bears living in the greater Yellowstone and Northern Continental Divide ecosystems.
Kristen Combs with the group Wyoming Wildlife Advocates worries that grizzlies could face the same fate as wolves if management is turned over to state. She points to recent moves by Idaho and Montana that have led to increased trapping, night hunting using infrared cameras, and year-round open seasons in a drive to reduce populations.
We've seen it with wolves. We see it with other large carnivores. There's nothing to say that that would not happen to grizzly bears if they were under state management as well.
Top Wyoming leaders, including Governor Mark Gordon and U.S. Senators John Barrasso and Cynthia Lummis, support delisting grizzlies. They say the bears have fully recovered and that it's time for Wyoming, not Washington, to be in charge of managing their future. Grizzly bears occupy just 6% of their historical range in the lower 48 states. Fish and Wildlife estimates there are just over 1,800 grizzlies living in the Yellowstone and Northern Continental Divide ecosystems, down from 50,000 that once roamed the West. Powerful livestock interests have long worked to protect their bottom lines when it comes to large carnivores. Combs points to programs that enable livestock and wildlife to coexist now at work.